Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to the Ron and Don Show. My name is Don Allen, and over in Studio B is Mr. Ronald A. Edwards. Mr. Edwards, it's raining outside. It's a cold rain.
Mr. Allen, count your blessings. This time last year on this exact date, we had about 4 inches of snow, and it was 20 degrees. And in 1991, we had a snowstorm of about 18 inches, if you will. And 75 years ago, by the way, it's interesting that you opened this issue up. 75 years ago, Mr. Allen, a significant number of Minnesotans died in a sudden blizzard that hit this state, caught a lot of hunters, basically, who were hunting grouse and pheasant and deer and et cetera back in that particular era. Many people froze to death where almost they stood. Others were found in their cars. It was a terrible storm. It was called the Armistice Day Storm. By the way, to you veterans, Mr. Allen, who have served our nation and et cetera, congratulations. This is Armistice Day, the day in which the conflict known as the First World War ended in 1918, November 11th, 1918. So, you know, my shout out to you and your fellow veterans. What is it now? 23 million veterans in our beloved nation, if you will.
Yeah.
Hopefully, we
a little
can
bit over 300,000.
Better than what we have been doing. A lot of stuff tonight, Mr. Allen. A lot of discussion going on with regards to I consider to be one heck of a coup by young African Americans at the University of Missouri. In fact, the Wall Street Journal in their editorial today took to task. What they said was the reason for it and the reason not for it, and et cetera, indicating that it was not the issue of race that drove the president of the Missouri higher education system and the chancellor at the University of Missouri at Columbia out of their jobs, that it was a multiplicity of other kinds of things. I just submit and maintain, Mr. Allen, and we will be having a caller who is a real kind of knowledgeable expert on that in just a minute or so, but I maintain it was that $100 million that was when those football players indicated that they had no intention of playing a game against BYU, Brigham Young University, at Arrowhead Stadium in Kansas City, in my hometown. The university was getting ready to forfeit $1 million right off the bat. They probably were not going to be able to play the remaining two games. And then when you talk in terms of what that would have done to the football program, Mr. Allen, do you know that that football program at the University of Missouri raised brought in $83 million in revenue last year?
Yeah, they need to be paying them players.
NCAA, you know? And the colleges.
Yeah.
Now, when you talk about slavery, that's really what collegiate sports is all about. We've touched on that over the years here on the Don and Ron program. Every once in a while, there's a little momentum, but by and large, you know, big business, big money puts that down, if you will, you know. And so, but anyways, I think we have a call.
Yes, we do.
Yeah.
Yes, we do, Mr.
And,
Edwards.
All right, let's bring our caller in and see what we have here.
Caller, you're live on the air. Go ahead.
Hi, my name's Steve. I'm calling from Missouri. And I had a question for Mr. Edwards. As I understand it, you had a conversation, was it this weekend or Monday with the president of the Missouri NAACP State Conference? Is that correct?
Yes, that is, sir. I had a conversation with Ms. Mary Radcliffe, who is both the State Conference President of the NAACP of Missouri, and she is also the President of the Columbia, Missouri NAACP, in which is the home mm-hmm. of the University of Missouri.
Yeah.
And yes, I did, sir.
Do you have
a question?
Was there any? Would you like to? Is there anything that you can tell us or about that conversation?
Well, you know, there is no prohibition, sir, with regard to what she and I discussed. We never indicated. I indicated to her that I was a journalist, also a native Missourian, and I was calling to get an update. I knew that there were problems and that there was going to be problems on the campus of the University of Missouri on Monday morning. She did confirm some things to me. I feel comfortable in discussing it. Number one, she and other adult, this is kind of important, gentlemen, because it's kind of something that was said by the Wall Street Journal in their paper today, that there needed to have been adult supervision of the black students. But anyways, she did share with me, Ms. Radcliffe did, that she and other African-American leaders in Missouri had been meeting and talking with Governor Jay Nixon, a man mm-hmm. who we, you know, heard his name quite a bit, sir, last year. I know a couple times, if I'm not mistaken, Steve, you had called in last year during the height of the Ferguson situation. The discussion, I thought, was very productive for me as a journalist. It gave me an insight into what some of the strategy was as of that Sunday. Things had really escalated in Missouri, and particularly on the campus, when the African-American members later joined by basically all of their teammates, white, whatever else, that they did not intend to play a game against Brigham Young there at your Arrowhead Stadium there in Kansas City. And that already there was a check for $1 million, a penalty for not honoring the contract. But what was further of concern to Governor Nixon and others was the possibility of the collapse $83 million football program brought in revenues last year of $83 million. And then with the possibility that the final three games on the Tigers' schedule, Missouri's nicknamed Tigers, at least they don't have, you know, one of those Indian names. But, anyways. And so the discussion went along the lines that there was pressure attempting to be put on civil rights organizations to, quote-unquote, get involved, help the young African-Americans get their minds right. And the only problem was is that these young students, in fact, the movement there, sir, and you're certainly there in Missouri, and I know that you have some reflections. The 1950 movement commences and recognizes the date that the University of Missouri was integrated, 1950. And so these young people had taken that, quote-unquote, as their banner, if you will. And so in the conversation on Sunday evening, the president of the Missouri State Conference, there was reflections about what was happening. At that same time, she received a call. She had been in consultation with the Columbia Police Department as well as the Sheriff's Department and the Missouri State Highway Patrol because there was concerns that there was going to be a faculty walkout at the University of Missouri on Monday morning, as well as there had been, and I understand something has developed there, and I would like if you could help us with this, understand that a neo-Nazi terrorist was taken into custody this afternoon after issuing threats to kill black people, if you will. I'm also aware that there have been a series of meetings in different locations in Missouri with our white, you know, activists, if you will, white supremacists, if you will. They require to be called activists. I don't understand that. But I do know that there was concern going into Monday morning. I think what we all now know President Wolf had made a decision actually late Sunday night, as I understood it in my conversation with the state conference president, that he would be stepping down. He had lost a lot of support on the board of curators. For those that do not recognize that in the state of Missouri, curators are the same as trustees or regents, if I'm not mistaken. And the board of curators, the governing board of the Missouri higher education system, which is comprised of four colleges, as I understand, had indicated that they could no longer support the president, and many were already saying on late Sunday night that $100 million and the collapse of the football program and et cetera, I think it's one of the reasons that the coach stood up. And so, yes, it was a very enlightening conversation with her. She was identified today in the New York Times, if I'm not mistaken, as being one of the key movers and shakers in putting some things together. But I can tell you that my other sources in your state indicate that, that these young people carry this situation on. Now, I have a question for you, sir, in that you asked us a question here. Can we get a little bit more background? Because I've been seeing a video. I told my colleague, Mr. Allen, I've been seeing a video of the former president, President Wolf, being very disrespectful to African-American students, activists, and et cetera, graduate and undergraduate. And I thought that it was a incident that took place in Columbia. I'm now told by additional sources that I talked to in Missouri that that video that has gone viral was actually taken outside of Kauffman, the Kauffman Fine Arts Center, named for Ewing Kauffman, the founder of the Kansas City Royals. Hey, right on, you know, Royals. Can you can you give us a little bit of background on some of the things that have happened, and do you have any reflections on the Wall Street Journal's editorial chastising the absence of adult supervision for the black students at the University of Missouri?
Well, I think one of the incidents I think that you're talking about there at the Kauffman Center for Performing Arts was probably the last time that the students actually confronted the president. The president had been ignoring them. And I think everybody's kind of seen the picture of the homecoming parade and the president in a car. And
oh, that big red, red, was that, red. Was that a Cadillac? Or?
I thought it was maybe a red Chevelle or something that he was
in.
And they stood in front of him, and of course, later he said he kind of regretted that he didn't get out and say something to him. So that was all part of they got no kind of response from the president, and then the response that they did get usually very often was somewhat offensive. When he was in Kansas City last Friday, it's November 6th, about 50 students or so.
How many?
About 50 of them from University from the Columbia campus and from the Missouri campus were outside the Performing Arts Center there. A few of them got in. They were then later escorted back out. But as the fundraiser ended, President Wolf came out and was confronted by some of the students. And there is a video, and I think you just referred to that video. Is that what you were?
Yes, the video, which I thought was a video from an incident in Columbia on the campus of the University of Missouri. I did not realize that that this incident had happened, and that as an outgrowth. Well, here's what I understand, Steve.
Okay.
That as an outgrowth of that particular incident, there were a lot of donors and supporters of the University of Missouri system, because you also had a lot of alumni from the University of Missouri at Kansas City.
Uh-huh.
And I understand a lot of people were somewhat shocked at some of the allegations that were directed towards President Wolf, and I also understand Chancellor Lofton was also with him, and that kind of began a domino effect with regards to many of the big donors. I guess the way you guys do it down there in Missouri, you have kind of – it's kind of east meets west in Missouri, and so Kansas City is kind of the center of the western part of the state, right?
Yeah, yeah.
St. Louis is the center of the eastern part, and so when you do things like, you know, fundraising and getting with your donors and kissing the ring or have them kiss the ring, that you choose those two cities. And so I understand that function last Friday was for the big donors in western Missouri. Am I correct on that?
Oh yeah, they were surprised by the protest. I mean, this isn't a story that got a lot of airplay or anything here in Missouri. So I think a lot of those donors were, a lot of them were shocked by the protest. They weren't exactly sure what was going on or what the issues were. And I just wanted to read, if I could, just a little bit of the transcript of that video.
Oh, you have a copy of the transcript of the confrontation between he and the students. Let's go right ahead, our program, Mr. Allen and myself. Go right ahead.
Yeah, I just kind of wanted to give you an idea of what that the students were dealing with. Somebody in the crowd said, "Tim Wolf, what do you think of systematic oppression is?" And then President Wolf said, systematic oppression is because you don't believe that you have the equal opportunity for success." And then someone in the crowd then came back to him and said, "Did you just blame us for systematic oppression, Tim Wolf? Did you just blame the black students?" He actually was unresponsive to any of the demands of the black students, really wouldn't meet with them or anything. And that was the sort of attitude that they were kind of dealing with. So
that continued to aid and abet a continued deterioration of his relationship. Is it factual? Because this is not in the Wall Street Journal editorial, but it has been brought forward by other sources that we've talked to during the day in preparation for this program, that he had a meeting with the deans of all of his colleges, and they at the University of Missouri at Columbia, that they basically indicated a vote of no confidence, President Wolf had in fact fired the director or the dean of the medical school.
Yeah, it's actually kind of interesting because the deans of the school, a lot of the faculty, the meeting that he had two meetings, one in October, actually two of them in October, with the deans of the various colleges, and they had asked for the resignation of Chancellor Lofton. And then, you know, once again, as usual, President Wolf didn't respond. I mean, there was nothing. He just basically, I don't know if he didn't listen or what happened, but the day that he resigned, the deans put a letter, which is November 9th, out demanding the resignation of Chancellor Lofton at that point. And one of the, and I'll just read you part of the letter. It says, "We strongly support our students and agree with students, staff, and faculty that the handling of race and cultural issues on our campus by our chancellor has led to significant damage. Additional examples of the chancellor's failed leadership include graduate student health, elimination of vice chancellor for health sciences position, firing of medical school dean, and creating a toxic environment through threat, fear, and intimidation." That was from the deans of the colleges. So that gives you an idea of what, just how serious the situation.
And if I understand it, Steve,
yeah,
there are at least 9 signatures on that letter from 9 deans of 9 of the colleges,
yeah,
there on the campus of the University of Missouri at Columbia.
That's right.
And again, what was the date, sir, on that letter, the 9th,
well, that,
just a couple
that
days
was
ago?
The 9th. Yeah, that was actually, this. They presented this letter just prior to the resignation. So it came actually the same day. So they were demanding that Wolf, President Wolf, actually fire the chancellor at that point. But as it turned out, the president ended up resigning and the chancellor both resigned. So
right.
Yeah.
So the Wall Street Journal, gentleman, my colleague, Mr. Allen, who was obviously in studio listening, so the Wall Street Journal did some selective reporting, just as the Kansas City Star and the St. Louis Democrat, Post-Democrat newspaper, some selective reporting, because as I understand it, the incident in Kansas City at Kauffman, and I understand, you know, Kauffman is named for one of the most beloved and prestigious individuals, the man who actually brought Major League Baseball back to Kansas City, Ewing Kauffman,
yeah,
who was a billionaire and et cetera. But the Kansas City Star, the prime newspaper there in your city, they didn't print anything about the incident. Am I correct? Or
yeah, we're still looking for the article about that. We're still trying to find it in the Kansas City Star.
I
can't find anything yet. Yeah.
Right. Well, let us ask this question here, and of course, if my colleague Mr. Allen has any questions, certainly just fold on in. I'm a little concerned, particularly as in my role as a federal monitor for the Department of Justice here in Minneapolis, the response of certain white supremacist groups. Is there some danger there? Because I've heard some of the black students say that they don't feel safe there on the campus and have not felt safe for a long time. And I saw interviews with a couple of the professors there, African-American professors, who also indicated the issue of safeness, you know. And so,
yeah.
How are things really there? Because I think back to my conversation with the NAACP State Conference President on Sunday evening, where she was in consultation with the Columbia Police Department there in Columbia, Missouri. I mean, are our black youngsters in some kind of danger?
You know, I think things have calmed down a little bit lately, but one of the things that your listeners might want to keep in mind is that that part of Missouri going south into southern Missouri is really a haven of neo-Nazi activity. There are a lot of camps down there. And so there have been rumors of Ku Klux Klan activity on the campus, et cetera.
For those that read the maps, when you talk about going south from Columbia, you're talking about going, of course, towards the state capitol in Jefferson City, as they like to say.
Yeah,
but then as you move further down towards the Ozarks and et cetera, and by the way, the terrorist who posted the statements that he was prepared to kill African Americans, he was located in what town there in Missouri?
In Rolla, Missouri.
Okay.
Small. And actually, there's actually his name is Hunter Park. And
could you repeat that again?
Hunter Park.
Oh, okay.
His name. Yeah, and he was he's 19 years old, but he was on something called Yik Yak, I believe it's called. It's
okay.
Something that's part of the social media, and he made some. Well, he made a lot of statements. One of the statements that he made was that he was going to exercise his right to stand his ground and shoot every black person he saw. So,
okay.
Yeah.
He was arrested by state or federal authorities this afternoon?
He was arrested, I believe, by, well, he's in the Boone County Jail, so I believe he may have been arrested by the state police.
Okay.
Yeah. He was
this
enrolled,
comes at
so
a time when there have been postings out of Sandpoint, Idaho, which is the bastion of the white supremacist organization, as well as York, South Carolina, and Mars Hill, North Carolina, that we've reported on this program. You know, I have to indicate that I am concerned with regards to retaliation. And I think in some regards, the Wall Street Journal in their editorial today kind of indicated that Negroes had, quote-unquote, kind of stepped out of line. And also, I repeat again what I said at the top of this discussion with Steve, that the Negroes needed adult management. You know what I'm saying. Could you give us an update, because I also want to touch on something else that I'm aware that you have expertise in. Is there anything else that we need to know at this particular hour in other places around the country? And, of course, we're broadcasting out of the Twin Cities of Minneapolis and St. Paul. What do you see happening as it pertains to the future?
Well, I think right now I think the Missouri MU campus, well, the whole Missouri college system has a real problem right now with PR. I don't know about the football team. This is something that's going to continue on for quite some time, I'm sure.
You're one of many that I've talked to in the last 3 days that has said that. You know, normally you would think people would say everything is, you know, going to be taken care of and we're going to correct this pretty quick. Could you give us kind of your the basis for that statement?
Well, see, I think what's happened is, well, for instance, today I think there was an executive meeting of the curators today. So, I mean, obviously that was a closed meeting. And they're talking in terms of adding, I guess it's called a diversity officer.
Vice president, I understand
from
my sources
and
the NAACP there in Missouri.
Yeah,
In fact, they CNN was reporting late yesterday that the person had already been identified and hired.
Yeah. Well, I think there's a gentleman named Chuck Henson, I believe is his name.
Okay,
and
that sounds on point.
Yeah, he.
Now is he is he a Caucasian or an African American?
No, he's African American.
I see. Okay.
Yeah, he was an associate dean of the law school.
Legal background. I see.
Yeah, exactly.
You'll definitely need that. All right. So Mr. Henson is the person that is now being identified as the new vice president of diversity, integration, harmony, and et cetera at the university.
Yeah.
Well, actually, would he be for the entire system, the other three colleges that are part of the system, or just the University of Missouri at Columbia?
I believe it may just be for Columbia. I'm not sure about that.
Okay. But let me do this because my co-host has certainly been holding. We have some additional local things. We had, in fact, attempted to reach you last week, given your aviation background and experience and knowledge. This situation in the Middle East with the Metro airliner, Russian carrier. Some are saying that that an explosive device on that aircraft may very well have been a pressure bomb. But where do you come out as a person who has many hours of flying and also air controller, et cetera? What is your take on what happened, sir, with regards to that aircraft?
Yeah, I mean, it could have easily been a bomb. I mean, it wouldn't take very much, particularly like in the cargo hold, to breach the pressure hull of that aircraft and bring it down. So, and planes nowadays, they're so well designed that actually having one just fall apart in the sky really doesn't make it sense. So it had to be, yeah. I mean, and also I think it was around 2005. There was a terrorist attack in this. I think it's Sharma El Sheikh.
Same place.
There was a big terrorist attack there, and actually it was really directed at the Egypt itself by a terrorist organization, but it was aimed at the tourist industry, I believe, in Egypt.
Okay, and that's 2005, yeah. We have been discussing that with some of our foreign colleagues and et cetera, that this is probably another effort to seriously undermine what is really the most significant, because, you know, Egypt has no oil, so that tourism is one of the most significant economic platforms that they have.
Yeah.
But how do you read, and then we'll let you go, we appreciate you taking half hour with us, but how do you read the kind of fragileness as it pertains to not ranting and raving of the Russians with regards to any retaliation once they determine who it was that was involved in placing a bomb upon that aircraft?
Okay, you mean what their response?
Yes, what we could expect from the Russians.
I think Vladimir Putin is. I have no doubt that there'll be some major retaliation, maybe against ISIS and some other groups there.
Let me ask this question of you, Steve, also giving you background. I have said, based on intel that we've been receiving, is there the possibility of the Russians using low-yield nuclear tactical weapons against ISIS?
It's possible. I think I'm not exactly sure exactly how far Putin wants to go.
Okay.
But, I mean, that's always possible. I know that the Russians have used extreme measures in the past.
Particularly against the Chechens.
Yeah.
Yes.
The Chechens, exactly.
Okay.
Yeah. So, I mean, I wouldn't put it, that would be I don't know, internationally. I'm not exactly sure how that would be viewed by the rest of the world.
Right.
I don't know if Putin would want to do that or not, but I have no doubt that there will be a major retaliation by Putin.
Okay, and punishment.
Yeah.
All right.
Mr.
Allen, do you have any questions of our caller?
No, but I'd like to say, Mr. Edwards, since the incident in Missouri, you have college campuses, major college campuses, including the ones in Minnesota, sending out email surveys to their students about diversity.
All right. Oh,
yes.
I'm okay.
Yes.
Steve, could you just stay with us as my colleague lays this out, because he had said this in our production meeting. What institutions are we talking about, Mr. Allen?
Well, you know, Mr. Edwards, I'm a graduate student at Hamline University in St. Paul, and there was a major email that came out from the president and from what's called the Hedgman Center, mostly for the GLBT group of students, concerned about diversity. And there's a push for the students to answer this survey because they're really concerned. And that's a knee-jerk reaction, because also this happened when the shooter at the college campus on the West Coast, I think it was, earlier this year.
Yeah.
They sent out surveys.
University of Oregon, yes. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and questionnaires about the safety. Do you feel safe here? And this is just something that's happening at the University of Minnesota. All the major campuses here in town are asking their students about diversity on campuses. And it's kind of funny because, you know, they talk about diversity. I always say it's a horse that has to be put down, and it's not a pet, because they don't really understand what it is they're supposed to be doing when it comes to diversity. Diversity doesn't mean, especially on my campus, it doesn't mean six white people dressed in blue jeans and dresses and short hair and long hair, which is mostly the definition at Hamline, which is very scary to begin with. So yeah, it's troubling to see this and to see these reactions and see these people hustle and just a response. But students do have a lot of political clout, and you saw a fine example of them using it in Missouri.
Let me just also say this for the purpose of transparency. Mr. Allen, my co-associate and co-host, also has periodically pointed out that the new president at Hamline, for the first time in its history, and only the second time by gender, is an African-American. And so that we watch Hamline very closely, as Mr. Allen knows. And again, Steve, I know you're still with us. We watch that pretty closely because, you know, everyone wants to see how the black president of the college is going to handle questions of diversity and et cetera. Steve, can I ask you a question? Are you getting any feedback of similar kind of dispatches and et cetera being sent to the local colleges there, like, what is it, Rockhurst, of course, University of Kansas City, University of Missouri at Kansas City, et cetera? Are you able to speak to that?
Well, I know that the University of Kansas, I believe they're going to have meetings maybe this weekend, I think it is, concerning diversity and other things on campus. One of the things I kind of wanted to point out, too, is that a lot of these, you know, you can have diversity on campus and have African-Americans in, you know, high positions, visible positions. But one of the things that's happening on a lot of these campuses, too, particularly in Missouri, is that you're actually having a cultural clash between students, black students going to a campus and then having to face racial slurs and other things from students there who I don't believe have had any, basically no black people from television coming from, you know, I hate to put it that way, but that was one of the things in this whole thing with Missouri. A lot of these students have had racial epithets thrown at them and from other students on campus.
Right.
So, I mean, there's a real sort of, I guess, cultural or something problem there that really needs to be looked into, too.
And I remember some situations both at Warrensburg and but also in our Springfield, where you have two fairly large-sized colleges, Drury College, and there's one other there, and that is down in the heart of Billy Bob's land. And, in fact, Springfield always comes to mind because I had worked closely with the then president. This was 10 years ago, Mr. Allen. With the then president of the NAACP of Springfield, very courageous black woman, after a young African American was hung in Springfield. For those that know that city, they have a big TV tower downtown. Am I correct on that, Steve?
That's right. That's right.
And one morning, a decade ago, almost, a young Negro, African American, black, if you will, was found hanging from that downtown tower, and it shook the very foundation of Springfield and the surrounding area. No one was ever apprehended, and as I said, for a period of time, we worked closely as a kind of an advisor. At that time, I was active in the NAACP with the NAACP president in Springfield, who really fought hard to try to get justice, but it never happened. In fact, let me just ask our guest. I mean, was there ever any resolution? Maybe it happened 2 or 3 or 4 years later. Was there anyone ever apprehended for the lynching of that young African American?
No, there never was. And I think the the mother of that young man has complained about that for years after that took place.
That's what I was kind of getting to and reflecting on. Okay, all right.
Yeah, there was no, and I think I'll have to sort of revisit that, go back and look, but I believe there was also some issue with the medical examiner's report with that incident.
Yes, because they initially tried to say it was suicide, but the way that he was strung up, and he was rather up high. Whoever murdered him took him and took him fairly, at least halfway up the tower.
Yeah.
He had also been beaten, Mr. Allen. It's one of those situations that was not talked about. Springfield has a fairly, what would you say, Steve, maybe 2,000 to 3,000 African Americans there in Springfield, including students and et cetera?
Yeah, that's a very small percentage.
Okay.
Yeah.
Mr. Allen, anything else, any question you have for our guest?
No, I'm fine, well-informed.
All right. Colonel, I mean, Steve, we want to thank you for taking the time to join us, and we'll be waiting to hear from you if there's any significant events in Missouri and particularly around Columbia. Thank you again, sir.
Okay, well, thank you.
Thank you.
All right.
Thank you very much.
Mr. Allen, your take, and our phone lines are open. We apologize. Our phone lines will now be open. If anyone has any observations or et cetera. but what is your observations, sir?
I just think that the whole situation of how those guys organized in Missouri and pulled this nice little coup off is a great example of what us non-athletes and business people, African-American, Black-American, need to do to set things straight. Because if you hurt their pockets, and what I mean there, the white male patriarch infrastructure, you can actually make some changes. And it's too bad that we have to be this radical, or they have to be this radical, but there was no other way they could change what was going on down there. So, I've been looking at the Wall Street Journal, a couple other little articles here and there. A lot of bloggers are still talking about it in depth and down that way. And I don't think this is something that's going to die out. I think that this might catch fire and you might see some copycat stuff going on in a good way, so people can
change. Did we not hear on our internet and some of our stringers that work for us cross country, is there not a situation going on now, right now, at Ithaca, New York?
I think there is. Let me look at the wire here because I think I saw something.
Mm-hmm.
Let me just look here. I'm pulling it off the wire because I was just by there. No, I do not have that update. I just submitted it. We should have it, though, Mr. Edwards, before the end of the show.
Okay, all right. Just give our phone number.
Mr. Edwards?
Phone lines will be open because we have some local things to also go to. Phone lines are open. I certainly appreciated the report from our caller, Steve, in Missouri. And, of course, we kind of identified the fact that he is apparently located or assigned to Kansas City, Missouri.
Yeah, and Mr. Edwards,
go right ahead.
That phone number is 347-426-3904. Again, that phone number is 347-426-3904. And I just want to tell you, Mr. Edwards posted today, November 11th at 5:09 p.m., Ithaca College students organized solidarity walkout protesting racially charged incidents on campus. And it's from the Daily News, New York Daily News. So that's a credible source. Hundreds of Ithaca College students walked out of class Wednesday to protest a series of racially charged incidents on campus. Following the lead of the University of Missouri students, the Ithaca protesters demanded resignation of the college president, Tom Rashawn, who was accused of ignoring tense racial climates in the upstate New York campus. It's all right there on Google New York Daily News, Ithaca College, and it came back pretty quickly there.
You know, something that's interesting about that has a flavor here from Minnesota. If I'm not mistaken, Ithaca, which was just down the road from my alma mater, the University of Syracuse, that the chancellor of the higher education, New York State Higher Education, is the former vice president at the University of Minnesota, Robert Jones, our good friend Robert Jones.
Yes, yes. That's he's
out
there.
Maybe we can reach out to Robert, and maybe we can get him on the air next Wednesday to kind of enlighten us, let us know what happened up there. Our caller clearly indicated, and I've heard similar reflections from others in the state of Missouri over the last, 48 hours, that we can see a possible escalation. I think that's what the Wall Street Journal, because at the very end of today's editorial, they said, because more of this is going to happen, And this is is consistent with the text messages and chatter, and everybody likes to use the word chatter, that is coming out of places like Sandpoint, Idaho, if you will, York, South Carolina, Mars Hill, North Carolina, all sites of neo-Nazi training facilities and et cetera. And, by the way, they really suppressed it. We had the arrest of a couple of neo-Nazis in Virginia. Maybe we can sign that while we talk. White supremacists who were plotting, as was the little terrorist who shot and killed 9 African-Americans at a church doing service in Charleston at Mother Emanuel, AME Church, Dylan Roof. These individuals actually had been in York, York, South Carolina, and Mars Hills, North Carolina, which are both facilities where training is going on, if you will. The FBI apparently took them down a day and a half ago, saw nothing in the paper, and CNN and the rest of them stopped running the story at approximately 2:30 p.m. Eastern Standard Time yesterday. Isn't that fascinating?
Yes, it is. Mr. Evers, we do have a telephone caller.
All right, let's get the caller in.
Let's get him on here. Caller, you are live on the air. Go ahead. Who's calling?
Good evening. Good evening, gentlemen. This is Mr. M.
Doing, sir? Thank you for calling in. Your observations, sir.
I'm doing very well. Your observations are so timely. By the time, listening to just the beginning portions of your program, it's just so riveting. At one point, my first comment would be how when these type of conspiratorial type things happen against the community, even right here in the Twin Cities, some of these same names seem to pop up. Mentioning the name Robert Jones, somehow, how do these same names, way out in New York, but yet and still there's some connection to what's going on here.
Yes, it is, sir. Yes, it is.
Going to which we've talked about before, the Mr. Giacchetti and things over on the north side with Mr. Jones was very prominent in before going to New York.
Mm-hmm.
So I thought that's very interesting how these names continue to pop up. But also in regards to what you're talking about in the Missouri situation, as you gentlemen have really pointed out, as I saw it, one of the things that was really interesting to me was how these football players said that they weren't going to play.
Yes, sir.
And I think that's what seemed to really see. And this is not your All-America players. This isn't a team that anybody knew anything about, really. It's probably a 500 team.
For our listening audience, their record is in fact 4-5.
Okay.
Four wins, 5 losses. Though for the last prior 2 seasons, they were the West Division champions, having 11 win seasons of the SEC. That's the Southeastern Conference. So they had a pretty good program. They were kind of down this year. Some are now saying that lot of it had to do with the tension, undercurrents, and et cetera on the campus. But you're on point. Their record right now going into the game with Brigham Young at Arrowhead Stadium on Saturday afternoon is 4-5 losses.
And for them to take that stance, because the college was really put in, if they weren't to play that game, millions of dollars are going to be lost. Advertising, these games are set with tickets and cable and all these things around the country. I mean, that stopped the wheel.
Yes.
And that got a lot of attention by them doing that. And what another thing that pointed to me about that is that those are individuals that in one way they really didn't have much to lose. I mean, when you look at it from a sports perspective, I mean, you can't, like athletes today, you know, your LeBrons and your Jeters and them. We talk about how they don't speak out and how they don't, but see, they have so much more to lose by doing that.
Right. Let me just say this, though, as historical. LeBron James, and at the time of the Trayvon Martin situation, if you remember, was playing for Miami. Miami was fined $250,000 by the NBA for in the game immediately following that entire tragedy, outrageous murder of that young man. The NBA fined Miami because all them brothers came on the floor with hoodies. I don't know if you gentlemen remember that. And that was led by LeBron and Dwayne Wade and et cetera. And some of our quote-unquote black commentators, like, you know, even my friend Stephen F. Smith and et cetera, were very passive. But I have to say, in the defense of some of those ball players, and then the whole situation with Donald Sterling. In fact, gentlemen, Donald Sterling got $2 billion for being a racist, sold the team, and we don't hear nothing more about his outrageous conduct.
Sure.
$2 billion, Mr. Allen, you know, because my friend Mr. Allen is not necessarily a sports enthusiast, but Donald Sterling sold a franchise that initially was valued at about $900 million, sold it for $2 billion just to get him out of the game after his outrageous comments about African Americans. I just said, actually, last year to my colleague, Mr. Allen, who I know is not necessarily a sports enthusiast, that racism does pay. And I'm the audience back to Donald Sterling. Racism does pay. I apologize to cut you off. You had some other observations.
Well, yes, it just points out to me, I mean, if they could do that on that level, and I think as Mr. Allen was really pointing out, I mean, what they've shown is they found an Achilles heel in this thing. And, you know, I mean, it could go on and on to the point of, I mean, these college athletes are being exploited, I mean, infinitum. I mean, they're generating as many dollars as they are on the pro level. And if you recall, years ago, I don't remember exactly when this was, but there was a team that threatened to not play an NCAA basketball title game.
Yes,
and see, and those are the things that can really, really, really shake up this whole apple cart. But that team, they were threatening to not play. And I'm telling you, there was a lot of nervous people, and somehow they got them to go ahead with that game and play.
Yeah.
That carry was in the 90s.
Yeah,
I don't know.
And I'm thinking hard on it myself right now.
It was UCLA, or if it was, it wasn't like a Kentucky or none of them.
I'm pretty sure it was a West Coast team, and it may very well have been USC or UCLA.
Yeah.
It had to do with the tensions in LA after the Rodney King incident.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Yeah.
After the Rodney King incident. And,
exactly.
Yes. And these black athletes stood up. Let me say this also for the purposes of history, gentlemen, because history was once again reinforced. Notice I used the word reinforced. A very rich history, which unfortunately, you know, gentlemen, we don't even have a Black History Museum here in the Twin Cities. $3 million
pitiful.
Can't be explained. But do you know, gentlemen, who the first black athlete was that used that kind of leverage in this particular era, if you will, to force some change on the field of competition and et cetera?
Wasn't he
a boxer? 1919. It'll be in my column, and I'll share it with our listening audience, because I know both of you would have great appreciation for this gentleman, who was also an All-American. Oops. Walter Camp, All-American. Walter Camp was a white man, sports writer, was the only one allowed to declare who was an All-American back in those days. the legendary and beloved Paul Robeson.
Paul Robeson in many fields.
The man was a Renaissance man. I refer to him at all times as a Renaissance man.
One of the great baritones of all time, and
a political leader, and et cetera, who was, you know, very poorly treated by this country because he stood up for the African American. It was a popular thing back in the 1930s, into the 40s, into the days of the Un-American Activities Committee, and et cetera, just to say that a Negro was a communist, and that dismissed all of the platforms that person, he or she, was involved in. Our own beloved Nellie Stone Johnson here was at one time banished from the Democratic Party because she was accused of being a fellow traveler, which, as you gentlemen know, is the code word for being a communist. She only was allowed, though we young African Americans, as you remember, forced them to open the door back up for Nellie, and she made a tremendous comeback in this city. She was the, for those that, you know, don't know our history, she was the third African American ever elected to public office in the state of Minnesota. The first was her father, elected to the school board in Dakota County. Oops. Yeah. But when I saw what those young African Americans were doing, gentlemen, I was well reminded of the following: not only Paul Robeson in 1919, but I was then reminded of a more modern flavor, and that was Bill Russell, Kareem Abdul-Jabbar, Wilt Chamberlain.
I can well remember those photos: Kareem Abdul-Jabbar, Jim Brown.
That's right.
Bobby Mitchell.
Yeah,
I mean, from every sport, from every major sport, they got together.
Jackie Robinson, we don't want to indicate that.
Jackie Robinson, and I mean baseball players, basketball players, football players, and these were the top, most valuable people to make a real statement. And see, and they had a lot to lose by doing that.
But they had a lot to gain, gentlemen.
They had a lot to gain.
That's right, because when you say a lot to lose. Muhammad Ali, who lost at least $60 million in the 6 years
that
he was barred from boxing.
Career.
He
lost the heart of
from
his
boxing,
career.
At least $60 million in purses and et cetera.
Yeah.
Just a whole host of African Americans who stood up. And then we had people like Wilma Rudolph. We don't want to leave out black women, if you will, particularly Wilma Rudolph, one of the greatest sprinters in the history of the game. Mm. But because our history has been so suppressed,
Boy, Althea Gibson, tennis, wow.
Yeah, my God. Arthur Ashe, you know. you know, Charlie Sifford, Pete Brown, and et cetera, in golf. You know, I mean, we all talk about Tiger, you know, and you know, God bless him, and heck of a player, great, and should go down in the annals. But there were others that came before him.
But I think you and I, Mr. Edwards, you know, by seeing these individuals, these young men in Missouri kind of rallying around, I mean, I really did something to me. That really was hopeful. I was really glad to see that, you know, and hopefully they can rally into, you know, a purpose, because usually these things can, as Mr. Allen was saying, you know, spread to other campuses, spread to other, you know, get this administration to start talking about it, and it can be a domino effect. I mean, when you look at, you know, for students that aren't in athletics, which are many more than the students that participate in athletics, the fees that they're paying, you know, coming out of college with $50,000 and $60,000 of debt, I mean, that's deplorable. I mean, we need these individuals, young people, to keep this society going. And to continue to put this albatross on them so that, I mean, the president of that Missouri college is making over $500,000. For what?
Yeah, really.
Yeah. Absolutely correct.
Okay.
All right.
Okay, gentlemen.
All right, Em. Appreciate it. By the way, anything, last week we were talking because you joined us on one late. Any additional things that you want to share with us on your trip to South Africa?
Oh, yeah, gentlemen, you know, I'm still winding down from the long flight and, you know, coming back. Not, you know, I got waylaid coming back and I had to go through Dubai, which
was
an experience in itself. I mean,
okay.
I mean, the plane, I mean, the opulence, the money that they have in that oil area, man, it's just, I mean, it's just unbelievable. But the South Africans really, it really just struck me again that this is really, it reminded me of, I grew up in the 50s in this country, and that's kind of what it reminded me of there, being back in the 50s or 60s. I mean, with them being so close to breaking those chains of apartheid, such as they were, they still have a real uphill battle to go through. I mean, you have millions of people there that have been undereducated. And one of the things that I was there doing, you know, supporting my sister, the doctor who had been brought there to help this particular college learn how to teach these students who, in their lifetimes and generations, these were throwaway people that they felt that they couldn't learn, that these were people that didn't warrant being in a higher education environment.
Uh-huh.
I mean, their mentality was so clear. And she and my sister was there talking, you know, teaching in one of her classes, and how she said that they're starting at square one. These instructors, they need to get more instructors from the African community that can wear into the current structure so that they can begin to learn how and respect the fact that there are bright students there, and how are you going to teach those students?
Okay. Okay.
I don't know if that makes a lot of sense to you.
Oh, definitely it does. Let me ask you this question, because, as you know, I'm certainly a military historian, et cetera. What did you observe as it pertains to the military there in South Africa? I mean, did you see a military that was integrated, if you know what I mean? Because I know that one of the particular disciplines of the South African Armed Forces is that basically it's still white folks. I'm Mr. Allen, as a former military person. It's still the white South Africans that are flying the jet planes and et cetera. I'm talking about the fighter planes and et cetera, if you know what I mean. Did you, was anything that you observed that caught your attention with regards to the presence of military as well as the national police?
You know, most of the police were really, the white, the Afrikaner. I mean, that was the majority. And again, most of the Africans, you know, their employment and what they were doing was mainly service jobs. They might direct some traffic. I mean, because, I mean, let's face it, I mean, it's 85%, 90% black.
Yes, right.
African. So, I mean, they pretty much run the whole, the engine of the country. But as far as pulling the strings, I mean, it was real clear that, I mean, you don't see walking downtown, you don't see any businessman types, you don't see any, you know, driving cabs, you know, setting up little shops, you know, to sell the trinkets and the little things around town, things that they may have made themselves. I mean, a lot of artistic, wonderful things you could see that they had made.
Mm-hmm.
But no, I mean, I thought it was really, and it's a real digging down of the whites to make sure that they know that this land is theirs.
Mm-hmm.
And there was a real violent stretch in some of the outlying areas where, I mean, they carry guns. And it's pretty lawless because some of the people are waking up to the fact, you know, these vast landowners and, you know, their families had been on that land for generations and they've been run off. And so there's an ongoing conflict. There's a kind of a tension there outside of the city.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know, man. It was a really eye opener, a real experience to me. I would encourage people to go there. I mean, you'll learn a lot, especially at their museums and looking at their history, and you can see how. I mean, we've just been so marginalized. I mean, not only here. I mean, it's like we're catching it here, but I mean over there. I mean, I think the opportunities are very, very sparse. I met some people from other areas like Cameroon and Nigeria, Lagos. They would come to South Africa and Cape Town and Johannesburg because there's more opportunity as far as jobs.
Mm.
Because there's like, it's like 25 or 30% unemployment in those areas.
Okay.
in the areas they're coming from was like 60%, 70%.
Yes, yes, yes.
I mean,
yes.
I saw people just handing out candy at a hotel, and I mean, has an advanced degree, him and his wife both, from Nigeria. They couldn't find any work, and they came back, you know, so they relocated to South Africa to try to find work, and they both found hotel jobs, and I mean, that's what they're doing to try to. Actually, a lot of them are trying to come here.
Yes. Well, you know, we have a strict policy as it pertains to blacks. Now, we don't have it for the Latino Hispanics.
No.
And
no,
white
we don't.
Russians and et cetera. But, you know, we have, Mr. Allen, you and I have talked about this before in production meetings. We have a very interesting immigration policy here about bringing people from the dark continents.
Mm-hmm.
Not the Asians, because we have a certain sense of fascination with what we consider to be their intellectual and academic background. But we have some real strict requirements as it pertains to immigration from the dark continents. So, yes, we want to remember that. By the way, I need to say this because we had a real strong flavor for a couple of years in this city about partnership with South Africa. From a number of black women. I remember a delegation that went to South Africa about a decade ago doing the truth and reconciliation hearings led by, at that time, then District Judge LeJune Lang, school board member Carol Ann White, you remember, a very active person here,
sure.
A number of other African-American women, et cetera. And they came back and held a series of seminars and forums to talk about Africa. And I remember they warned that this was a pattern. Now, this was at a time when the beloved Nelson Mandela was still alive and was certainly guaranteeing the lives of of the African and et cetera. But we appreciate your observations, with regards, because a lot of people just think that South Africa is run by the ANC. Yeah, it's a lot different. One of the things that Black African, the ANC, and the rest of them shouldn't have done, they should not have let the United States gentlemen and the European countries force the South Africans, the black South Africans, to abandon their nuclear programs as well as their nuclear weapons. That, I think you would agree, M, is another one of those hush-hush things that we're not supposed to talk about in America.
Mm-hmm.
See, at the time that the transition took place and Nelson Mandela became president, and if something was in none of the movies, by the way, that they made, I've always found it interesting how that's always absent, is that South Africa was required to relinquish its nuclear weapons. Do you remember that, Mr. Allen?
Oh, yes, yes. It was a done deal with South Africa.
Yeah, South Africa was... Now, South Africa was also a nuclear power, but was forced to do that. And, you know, no one ever likes to talk about it because it was... They were held hostage by the United States and the European nations of the United Nations.
Yeah, sure, yes.
Yeah,
absolutely.
And if they didn't
do
that, there would be additional problems and et cetera and et cetera. And that is something we probably can talk about at another time. If we thank you. We to see if we got any other calls. Appreciate it. And okay, thank you.
Okay, I'll hang up and listen.
Thank you.
All right. Take care, Mr. Allen.
Okay.
Do we have any callers on?
Yes, caller, you're live on there. Oh, they just hung up. Call your live.
Oh no, they're saying
you're
hello.
Live on air.
Hello.
Go ahead.
Mr. Edwards, I would like to go back real quick to talk about the Missouri University situation.
Yes, sir. Call.
And I would also like for people to pull out pens and paper, so when you answer some of the questions, they can go do the research themselves.
Go ahead.
The biggest thing is.
Could you turn? Do you want to turn down your TV or radio a little bit in the background? We can hear it.
Okay. The biggest thing about the University of Missouri, that football game was moved to Arrowhead Stadium. Arrowhead Stadium seats 76,000 people. And
That's right.
We're talking money, and the reason why I want people to grab a pencil See, the University of Minnesota, and that's why in Facebook people are starting to call out sportscasters like Stephen A. Smith. The University of Minnesota owns all the land around the University of Minnesota.
Uh-huh.
So the hotels, the sandwich shops, the pizzerias, the parking lots, the University of Minnesota owns that land. And those companies, even though those are brand name companies like McDonald's, Pizza Hut, et cetera, they pay rent to the University of Minnesota.
Uh-huh.
That's why the University of Minnesota wanted a stadium built on campus, because the stadium built on campus is actually 15,000 people less than the one that they play in on campus if they're still playing in the Metrodome.
Yeah, well, what you're saying is that the Metrodome, the old Metrodome, seated 15,000 more than TCF Stadium. And you're absolutely right, sir, that there was a lot of discussion, and the university became very insistent that they wanted to put the campus, they put the stadium back on the campus. And that's interesting what you reflected on, because it kind of talks in terms of the economics. My associate, Mr. Allen, while we were in the production meeting earlier today, has expressed some concern, and rightly so, about the latest move to hire and replace the departing Jerry Kill, who you know, clearly we want to be considered and respectful. Jerry Kill resigned because of health reasons. But Mr. Allen said to me, he said, well, Mr. Edwards, he said, when was the search done? Did they bother to go out and take a look at somebody else and et cetera? And I said, nope. It was a kind of a done deal, and it was kind of business as usual, if you will. And it continues to lend, a caller, and I think this is where you're coming from, it continues to lend to really the whiteness of the administration piece of the University of Minnesota.
That, and also the fact that this football class and basketball class represents the – I've been here since 1980. This represents the biggest and best athletic class in the history of the University of Minnesota. Well, you got Mr. Johnson coming from North High School, and you have several other homegrown black athletes who have decided to stay here, like Mr. Coffey's son from Hopkins.
Mm-hmm.
And because of the relationships that they've developed with their coaches, they did not want to disturb that apple cart because of the type of money that these boys can actually bring into the university, into the city. And what people don't understand is when these sportscasters talk about, well, you're getting a scholarship and you're getting free education, no, these are bought and paid for slaves. And if you look at the type of money that they generate compared to what they receive in scholarship, and there's no guarantee that they're going to get a job after they graduate. Oh, the black athletes don't graduate from University of Minnesota. They just finish academic qualification and they move on.
That's absolutely correct, sir. And that's something I've talked to my associate, Mr. Allen, about, because he has raised those questions about the graduation and et cetera. In fact, there has been no report on graduations, either the football and basketball. Now, you know, upon his departure, Coach Keel was praised by white commentators in this town as being, you know, really committed to academic achievement. I still haven't seen any figures of how many of the football team have actually graduated with degree. I know this. I know that the man who got the job as basketball coach because of his daddy is not graduating anybody over there. And by the way, guy, he's gotten kind of quiet, and his girlfriend, the reporter for the Minneapolis Star Tribune, have gotten quiet since the controversy and the scandal gentleman broke out about his daddy at the University of Louisville and the sex scandal there in Louisville with respect to the procurement of African-American women to service recruits and et cetera. I noticed that both father and son have been pretty quiet about that. And I know some of the black alumni have been running around talking about we don't want to talk about that, guys. But go ahead, sir. Other observations.
And it happened while the son was still at the university. if you follow the timeline. So no one know nothing about nothing, but all the money that these athletes bring to the university, to be honest and truthful, Mr. Edwards, I have a master's and two undergrad degrees. Forget about a degree. Give me a job that I can raise my kids, get me a house in the summertime, and have me a place to retire to once I reach 65. Because a degree don't promise you that. It just said you got a degree. And the reason why you have the problems here at the University of Minnesota, and you don't have that at Ohio State, and that's where I'm from, is because when the athlete finishes in Ohio State, they get a job. Be it a male or female, be it black or white, with the exception of that one running back that tried to go to pros from
right.
Ohio State, when is the last time or the first time have you heard of an athlete getting into any type of scandal? Now, in my 59 years, the only two athletes I've heard was the quarterback from Ohio State, and he became a gambling, and then the running back that won the national championship that Ohio State won the time before.
Mm-hmm.
So these people get jobs because the university invests in their future after they finish in university. And here in Minnesota, they don't invest in these athletes' future. Coffee's son is going to the U, but his two daughters graduated Parade All-American. That means they were some of the best female athletes to come out to the state.
Mm-hmm.
They didn't even think about going to the University of Minnesota. Why is that?
I think that only on this program will you hear a discussion and a reflection and a response to that question. We are not afraid to talk about what we just talked about minutes ago, about the kind of silence as it pertains to when did Pitino's son, who is the head coach here at the University of Minnesota, whereas his daddy's the head coach at the University of Louisville, what did the son know it, when did he know it, and what did he do about it?
And the saddest thing is they still trying to blame stuff on Clem Haskins, which he didn't really do. The reality of the scandal that hit under Clem Haskins, those two young African Americans out of Milwaukee, they was both on academic scholarship, and the last 2 years, because they stuck with the basketball program, Clem gave them a scholarship.
Mm-hmm.
Now that lady comes out the bag and she said that she wrote that boy's paper. No, she didn't write that boy's paper. I knew those two young men personally, and if you check the academic record, they didn't need nobody to write their papers because they were one of the highest academic programs at the university.
Yeah.
Plus, they was playing basketball on a national level.
Yeah, well, let me just say on that particular point, caller, I well know what you're talking about, and I have to say, gentlemen, I was right in the middle of bringing about that investigation, and I refer you to the book entitled Under the Tarnished Dome, which was about Lou Holtz, but there are two chapters in there about the University of Minnesota and the short time that Lou Holtz was here. And in those chapters are some of the very things that this caller is talking about. But I have to tell you, gentlemen, you're talking to a man who actually brought about, working closely with Robert Minix, the chief investigator for the NCAA at that time, now the athletic director at Florida State. We brought about that investigation, which exposed a lot of things, including the money man and et cetera, Luther Darville thrown under the bus. In fact, I testified at Luther Darville's trial. And, in fact, the judge at that time was so hot, him and the county attorney, Tom Johnson, was so hot they were talking about they were going to charge me with perjury for my testimony until the NCAA indicated over 200 discussions, gentlemen, between myself and them over a three-year period. And so, I clearly know what you're talking about as it pertains to Clem and corruption at the University of Minnesota. In fact, the corruption and the racism, have never gone away. All right. Thank you, caller.
And the last thing I'd like to leave you with, North High School is in the state final this Saturday at 10 o'clock at the University of Minnesota. I would like to see everybody turn up. That's a new word now, turn up, because do you know that the African-American mayor that's on the school board, when he was a city council person, he hollered, close North down. And he ain't been to no basketball games. He ain't been to no football games. And North is going to the state, in the state, for 2 years in a row. How can he be the city council person for the school board and he didn't want that school closed down 5 years ago? People forgot about that.
Oh, I don't think they did. I think people remembered it. And let's be absolutely clear, he is not the city council person for the school board. He was elected on his own as a member of the school board after stepping down from the Minneapolis City Council. But you know what I'm going to do on this, because I just received a text about 40 minutes ago, gentlemen, from one of the coaches on the Northside team indicating kind of a walk to the stadium from the north side of Minneapolis to let folks know that, you know, we're not a bunch of savages and animals. And I want to give a shout-out to the coaching staff and particularly to Charles Adams III, known as Spanky, if you will, who is also a Minneapolis police officer. And I think, caller, you have a great appreciation because I'm aware of who you are and I'm aware of your legend in Ohio Ohio football, particularly high school, et cetera. I just think that Charles Adams III and his father, Sergeant Charles Adams, worked very closely with him. In fact, he's the defensive backfield coach. They're just amazed. And by the way, congratulations to Tyler Johnson for being selected this past Sunday to the Star Tribune's All-Metro team at quarterback.
He also made the Marine Corps All-Star team, too.
That's right. He'll be playing in that Armed Forces game. Yes, sir.
Yes, sir.
All right. Thank you. Appreciate it. Take
care. Thank you, Mr. Edwards.
All right. Thank you, sir.
Thank you.
Yeah, well, you know, it's all about information, isn't it, Mr. Allen?
Yes, sir. Yes, sir. Absolutely. Sir.
Phone lines are still open. We have what, Mr. Allen?
About 7 minutes.
9 minutes. Do we have anybody?
No, that was your caller.
Okay. I know you wanted to also speak to the decision yesterday by Hennepin County judge. In fact, he's the chief judge, Peter Cahill. I see that he dismissed charges against 7 of the 18. My question is, what's going to happen to the other 11 people who don't have the resources or access to college libraries and et cetera, law libraries? You think they'll be released? I mean, what, you think that the charges against them will be dismissed also, and those charges are for trespassing? Should we be concerned?
I think that we should be very concerned, Mr. Edwards, because we can watch in real time how this group functions for people in their group. And if they don't function for this group, you will see a huge splinter effect. Some people starting to just throw folks under the bus. So I'm just, you know, in the case of that, I'm just going to sit back and watch. But, you know, with 7 minutes and 11 seconds left, Mr. Edwards, the stadium, the Vikings, the new Viking stadium and everything that's going on. And I looked over some things that were online because, you know, they tell you all the time, Mr. Edwards, it's online, go look online. And after I read pretty deeply, I called my buddy, who's a mathematician, and we sat down, had a little lunch, chopped it up a little bit, and together, you know, he left me with some thoughts. And with those thoughts, I came up with some questions. It says that, I wrote here, I like how the stadium looks. Probably never will attend any events there, because I never attended any events in the Metrodome. Here's the questions I have. Minorities Hires doesn't say much. Minorities must be disaggregated to paint the true picture of who got employed in the minority communities. Read state definition. I'll get to that. Question number one. They said 37% of the minorities got jobs. 37% of total numbers of jobs. What was that 30% out of the total numbers? What's that comparisons? Were they construction jobs, other types of jobs? What is the breakdown by job category? How long did the 37% have these jobs by category? Number four, what was the percentage and actual dollars earned from the total wages paid on the stadium product to each protected class? Minorities, African American, Latinos, Native, and Asian. That's just a few questions. Now, Minnesota Affirmative Action Law 43A Subdivision 33, protected groups. For affirmative action purposes, protected group means females, persons with disabilities, and members of the following minorities: Black, Hispanic, Asian, Pacific Islander, and Native Indian or Alaskan Native. So if they could break that down, I think we might see a little bit different than 37%. A lot different than 37%. I just want to throw
that
out there.
I have to tell you, I have to indicate that because I have those numbers. It'll be a whole lot less than 37%. It'll be a whole lot less than 17%. It'll be a whole lot less than 7%. Those numbers are bogus. I do know this. I know that the new strategy is now to talk about, our good friend Lewis King, we haven't heard from him for a long time, does have one of the concession stands there at the when the Viking Stadium opens for official business in September of 2016, which is, that's kind of interesting how that deal was cut. He currently has a concession stand at TCF Stadium doing the Viking football games, not the Gopher, but the Viking football game. He has some kind of concession stand over there. But the numbers that were presented by Mr. Tittle, who we invited to be on this program, and he has declined, the numbers just really don't match up. Now, I have the dollar amounts, and in fact, in fairness to giving opportunity to people to call in and vet us and et cetera, we will hold back. I'll hold back those numbers until next week. Though we did talk about those numbers in one of my columns a couple weeks ago, about what's really happening and not happening at the stadium. So whoever your mathematician was, I think that he has discovered what I have discovered quite some time ago, and that is that the numbers are quote-unquote bogus, and you raise some very good questions with regards to the questions that you're asking. A breakdown by see, you got to remember, Don, we talked about this. See, they started out. Kevin Lindsay, the commissioner of the State Human Rights Department, who now says that he has statutory authority to go over the figures. I don't know how he does that because they haven't done any site visits at all. He doesn't have enough personnel to do site visits, and his people are not trained in doing site visits. But he talked in terms of the numbers, and the numbers don't match up. Let me give you this example, and this is for our beloved listeners in North Minneapolis. There was special legislation put in by the Minnesota legislature, and in fact, Senator Bobby Joe Champion sits on the governing committee that is supposed to oversee the stadium and actually oversees the board that oversees quote unquote the day to day management, if you will, Sports Facility Authority. Take a look at the numbers coming out of 55411. And those numbers don't match the dollars, because what I was also saying is that, remember, when this thing started out in 2012, we were going to be dealing with our statistical data based on personnel. Remember that?
Yep.
And then
absolutely.
It got changed to hours, which really is something they should have left alone, because actually it's more demanding but more effective to talk about the hours that people are working. And I got to tell you, just in that particular area, 55411, which was specifically designated by the legislature along with a couple of zip codes in northern Minnesota on the Native American reservations, the numbers, Mr. Allen, and the dollar amounts, which is supposedly over $2.2 million, just doesn't match up, doesn't make sense.
No, sure doesn't.
Not when we get a report from a government entity, not from Don and Ron, but from the U.S. Bureau of Census, that talks in terms that we as an African-American community in 1 year's time, this past year, 2014, is going to really be a disaster when you get the statistics for 2015. We lost 15%. Of our economic base. I mean, how do you do
sure
that,
did.
Man?
Yeah, that's
I mean,
just
did we
scary.
Have an Ebola epidemic in the black community? And We lost 8 or 9 thousand African Americans, and that caused a 15% drop. I don't think so, but I would encourage anyone to give us a call next Wednesday and talk to us a little bit about zip code 55411.
I agree. Thanks for calling. Thanks for listening.
Keep living on our knees.